We're using the only tools we have available to us to do all we can to reduce the deficit.
Governor Walker announces more than $1 billion in budget vetoes. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 29th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, oil companies are furious at Governor Walker for vetoing tax credit payments.
The state can bully, you know, their way through, but it's not saving one penny by doing this.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. With a rich curriculum from art to advanced engineering, over 10,000 alumni strong, 90% of their students go on to four-year colleges or other post-secondary education. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
Governor Bill Walker cut permanent fund dividends today to $1,000 per person, about half of the projected amount. The cut was one of a series of reductions that Walker made to lower the state's budget by $1.5 billion. Andrew Kitchenman of APRN and KTOO in Juneau reports.
Walker says he's trying to reduce the amount of savings the state must spend to cover the budget. Without the cuts, the state is on track to empty its piggy bank in just 4 years. Walker says he cut dividends for this year so that residents will still receive PFDs in the future, and he'll take the blame for it. He expressed hope that this will make it easier for lawmakers to approve his long-term fiscal plan.
So what I've tried to do is take away from them the risk that they may suffer at the polls, so that's off the table. And any excuses now are just pure politics.
Walker vetoed $1.29 billion from the budget. The cuts include a $58 million reduction to education. The University of Alaska will see a $10 million cut. The state will delay $430 million in oil and gas tax credits in the future years. In addition to the vetoes, Walker delayed $250 million in road and bridge repairs. And he shut down two mega projects, the Kinnickarm Bridge and the Susitna-Watana Dam. But Walker says the state can't balance its budget only through cuts.
We're not cutting our way into prosperity. We're using the only tools we have available to us to do all we can to reduce the deficit.
Legislators from both parties criticized Walker's actions. Fairbanks Republican Representative Steve Thompson says delaying road construction work will cost a lot of jobs. Anchorage Democratic Senator Bill Willikowski says he'd like to see the legislature override the PFD decision. Three-quarters of the 60 legislators must agree to successfully override any of the vetoes.
The real losers today are working Alaskans who are really going to suffer. A family of four is going to lose over $4,000 from this action. And I think there are better ways to do it. I'm surprised the governor took this action, and I'm going to encourage fellow legislators to consider overriding this veto.
Nikiski Republican House Speaker Mike Chenault says it's not clear whether there will be enough votes to override Walker's vetoes in the special legislative session beginning July 11th.
It might have been nicer if early on at the beginning of session he would have came in with a smaller budget than what they originally proposed. So, we'll look at it, determine what's the right thing to do, and try to accomplish that.
Walker signed the operating mental health and capital budgets for the fiscal year that starts Friday. He also signed a bill that will restructure oil and gas tax credits, but not by as much as he wanted. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
This is Liz Ruskin. Governor Walker's vetoes fall heavily on K-12 education, which would lose $58 million. He says he had to do it.
We wanted to impact education as little as possible, but there had to be some modifications.
The largest share of his K-12 cut is to the account the state uses to partially reimburse local governments for school bonds. Walker, a former mayor and city councilman, says he's well aware his decision just takes that burden off the state.
It does shift it to the local communities, and we feel badly about that. This shifts it. I mean, everybody's going to be impacted in some way.
He also cut $10 million from rural school construction. Caroline Storm, an Anchorage architect and the mom of a sixth grader, says she hardly has words to describe her reaction to the school cuts.
Mind-blowingly disappointed.
Storm is a member of Great Alaska Schools, which has lobbied the legislature to maintain education funding.
I have talked to the governor myself several times personally. I have accosted him on the jetway of planes to ask him not to do precisely what he just did.
To Storm, the most painful part of the education veto is a smaller line item, a reduction of $6.3 million from the state's per-student formula funding. Storm says that will mean a loss of dozens of teachers and directly affect the classroom. Still, she doesn't blame Walker.
He was absolutely forced into all of these cuts.
Storm blames the legislature. She says lawmakers played partisan politics and did almost nothing to solve the state's budget crisis. The governor also vetoed $10 million from the University of Alaska and held back $80 million from the Higher Education Fund, which pays performance scholarships. The Anchorage School District says its share of the education cuts comes to more than $16 million, mostly from lost debt reimbursement. For APRN, I'm Liz Ruskin.
One of the vetoes announced today would eliminate $430 million in funding for oil tax credits. It's the second year Walker has used his veto power to cut funding for the program. Now, the governor is coming under fire from industry representatives and lawmakers who say the state is backtracking on what it already owes and still must pay. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney reports.
The credits were designed to encourage companies to explore and develop new oil fields in the state. But Walker says Alaska simply can't afford it right now.
You know, in some cases, we're paying as much as 85% of the cost of some of the projects. You know, that's a pretty heavy lift when you're basically borrowing money to pay those costs.
The veto doesn't let the state off the hook for the credits it already owes. It just delays the payments.
Basically, like just like tearing up your credit card bill. You know, it comes, oh, I don't want to pay it this much.
That's Benji Johnson. He's president of the small Texas-based company Blue Crest Energy that's developing an oil field in Cook Inlet.
The state can bully, you know, their way through, but it's not saving one penny by doing this.
Johnson says Blue Crest has received about $25 million in tax credit payments from the state in the last few years. But he says the state currently owes the company another $35 million, and he anticipates filing for $15 million more by the end of the year. Now, he doesn't know when he'll see those payments.
While we are aware, we're aware that this veto could happen, everything that we heard from the administration during this last session was that, oh, that's not going to happen again. We're going to make sure that it's fully funded. I mean, we were told that by pretty much everyone we've talked to.
Johnson says Blue Crest has been relying on the credits to help fund its drilling operations. He says the company has the money to get started, but may not be able to continue if oil prices stay low or drop further. Some companies have used the promise of tax credit payments to bring in outside investors. Johnson says the veto makes that option less likely for his company.
In the past, banks have been willing to loan that money at fairly low interest rates because they could be absolutely certain that, you know, that the state would pay that. Now, that certainty has absolutely gone away.
Lawmakers were also swift to criticize the veto. Republican House Speaker Mike Chenault says the state looks unreliable when it doesn't make payments it's guaranteed to companies.
I think it probably hurts independence. I think it hurts development of Alaska, whether it's in Cook Inlet or Prudhoe Bay. And I think it'll probably have detrimental effects into the future.
Lawmakers are scheduled to reconvene for a special session on the budget in mid-July when they could, in theory, override the vetoes. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rasha McChesney.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the struggle to find treatment for substance abuse.
I don't want to say they have nowhere to go because there still are options, but in terms of residential treatment, they don't have much of anywhere to go.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
In addition to detailing vetoes from the state budget, Governor Walker announced today he is shutting down two mega projects in the Mat-Su, the Kinnickarn Bridge and the Susitna-Watonna Hydroelectric Project. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
Large projects can often be contentious, and two of the more controversial projects in the last few years have been the Kinnickarn Crossing and the Susitna-Watonna Hydroelectric Project. Governor Bill Walker says those projects will now come to an end, not necessarily due to their controversial nature, Governor Walker describes himself as pro-construction, but due to the state's financial situation.
I ran for governor to build Alaska, not to come into Alaska to balance the checkbook, and we're balancing checkbook because that's the hand we were dealt. So it pains me to shut down anything involving a construction project or an infrastructure project.
Governor Walker says that the studies and prep work that have gone into both megaprojects will be preserved. Susitna-Watonna alone has spent nearly $300 million on studies as part of its federal licensing process, and Walker does not want that data to be lost. While the news of both projects shutting down represents potential future savings, neither has seen a great deal of activity of late. Susitna-Watonna has not received funding for 2 years, and a deal struck last year tied large-scale funding for the Kinnickarn Bridge to securing federal loans established by the Transportation Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act, or TIFIA. The Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities is the agency in charge of the bridge project. Shannon McCarthy, spokesperson for DOT, says that some preliminary work is ongoing, including continuing attempts at securing a TIFIA loan, but the level of field work has been low.
Any of the tasks that are in progress right now, if those can be quickly, you know, brought to a halt, completed and then brought to a halt, we would be doing that. And then other ones will have to, you know, we'll see where they're at in terms of their progress.
Both DOT and the Alaska Energy Authority, which handles the Susitna-Watonna project, are still processing exactly what the implications of Governor Walker's shutdown are. The Alaska Energy Authority plans to release a statement soon about what the next steps will look like. Susitna-Watonna's opponents, however, are very clear in their response to the governor's announcement. Mike Wood, president of the Susitna River Coalition's board of directors, says his group is ecstatic about the news.
On behalf of 13,000 Alaskan members of the Susitna River Coalition, we couldn't be more pleased with this with the governor's announcement. It's phenomenal.
Wood says the Susitna River Coalition will continue to watch Susitna-Watonna until it winds down completely, then we'll focus on making sure the idea of a dam on the Susitna, originally proposed 6 decades ago, does not come back for a fourth time. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Among the governor's vetoes was a $3.5 million cut to the Department of Corrections. Department spokesperson Corey Allen Young says they are looking at closing at least one correctional facility and possibly some probation offices, though he won't say which ones. He says the department is looking internally at possibilities.
As part of doing a study and researching to figure out which ones we can cut, well, that doesn't affect services and still provides a secure security and safety for our community.
Alan Young emphasizes facilities will not close overnight. Inmates will be moved to other correction centers and halfway houses or possibly put on ankle monitoring depending on the situation. Other possible cost-saving measures include reassigning employees to other facilities to reduce overtime payments and sending some inmates out of state again because it's significantly less expensive. Alan Young says the department will try to partner with more community agencies to provide treatment programs. Governor Walker's announcement that he will veto half of the amount for permanent fund dividends drew mixed reaction from Anchorage residents today. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early and Ammon Swenson talked to Anchorage citizens about how the dividend cut would affect them.
I think that it is a solution that is going to, you know, fix the budget crisis. And I think it's great that we have this, you know, option, because there's a lot of places where they don't have this kind of backup. So I think that the state is pretty lucky to have that kind of option.
But I feel like it's kind of wrong to assume that that money is going to be in your pocket. So me personally, I don't expect it to be damaging to my income.
I am a single mom too, even with trying to get assistance from the state too. It's been hard too as well since I've been working, and you know, the dividend kind of does play. I mean, everything's expensive here in Alaska.
I tend to kind of depend on, especially since now, in recent years, the PFD has gotten bigger, and it's gotten just a lot easier for me in that time span when we get our PFD. I kind of depend on that for bills and other kinds of stuff, and so making a cap on it, there's a lot of people that kind of depend on that money, not just me.
What the government's doing is whatever it takes, you know, to get our money back and build the economy. I think it's a smart move. I mean, I'd rather do that than have like sales tax or something like that.
You know, I really have no idea how to be a governor or anything like that. So, I mean, I understand he's got to make hard decisions at times, and it's not always going to be popular no matter what.
Needing that sustainability to pay our bills, to do other things. Like for me, I'm $20,000 in student loan debt right now, so that money would help a lot.
And obviously I will have less money, but I think the state needs it maybe more than we do right now.
I think that if they need to pull money from the PFD, I think that's fine.
I wouldn't say it's a terrible thing. I know some people depend more on the PFD than we do, but I mean, we have to pay for the government somehow.
I think that we need to do something. I think that the amount is probably the hardest thing to come up with is, okay, where's the cap on the amount? I'm glad that there is going to be a cap on the amount. I think that that will help the financial situation. Either taxing, or I'm in favor of all of those options. So yeah, I think that it's justified.
The voices of Anchorage residents Elaine Mano, Clay Opignano, John Borsted, William Borsted, Jennifer McKay, Alexia Gadea, and Zadie Manzano responding to the PFD cut. The Legislative Council voted today not to appeal a decision that upheld Governor Bill Walker's action to expand Medicaid eligibility in the state. The vote ends the lawsuit less than a week after a separate court decision ruled that the House can't take over the appeal from the Council. The Council voted 9-5 against pursuing the appeal. Every senator on the council except for Eagle River Republican Anna McKinnon voted not to appeal. Walker's administration cited state law that requires Alaska to expand Medicaid to meet federal standards. In the lawsuit, the legislature argued that since the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the federal government can't penalize states that don't expand Medicaid, Walker overstepped his authority in the expansion. But Superior Court Judge Frank Fifner disagreed.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The Business Administration program at Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive education grounded in real-world experience with life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. Move forward with APU and apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
Legally changing a last name is common, but what about changing your first name? It can be hard for people who've known you for years to relearn your name, but for Yadith Yadi Olson, the decision was an easy one. In this third story of a five-part series, Olson talks about why he thinks more people should start using their native names.
My name
is Yeh Yadi Olson. I am Duktain Ton Raven Tlinget and Tlait Ka Yetki. My name, Yeh Yadi, was first given to me by my grandma many, many years ago. It is the second of two Tlinget names that I have, and this was the name that I chose to go by legally. And to me, it just represents who I am as a human being, because I believe every Tlinget person out there deserves a name, a proper name, and I like to use it very casually in everyday speech. I like the fact that it's not anything ceremonial, it's not anything heavy, it's not anything deep, it's just a name. So me, as a human being, I'm represented by Yeh Yadi Olson all day, every day, all the time. So for me, it's who I am, it means it's me. And I changed my name legally like that just for one, because I like the idea of teaching people a little bit of Tlinket. I like, since I believe that all Native people were forced to use English, and now in today's world, it's my opportunity to force these same people to learn a little teeny bit about the Tlinket language. But it's very important, I think, that more people do the same thing that I did, and we have to start using these names because we're trying to revitalize and bring back our languages. And a part of that is using it every day.
That was Yeh Yadi Olson in the third installment of a five-part series on Alaska Native names produced by KTOO's Jennifer Canfield. A link to the full interview is at our website, alaskapublic.org. While more attention is being brought to solve the state's drug problems, proper services have always been hard to get in more remote areas. Detox facilities are not available in many communities, like Sitka. And with the use of harder drugs such as heroin and meth on the rise, the absence of those services is making it harder for those who need help to get it. In the second part of a two-part series on healthcare for drug addiction, KCAW's Brielle Schaefer visits the front line of treatment to learn what's working and what's not in recovery services for drug addiction.
I met with Jeff Arndt in his bright living room overlooking Sitka Sound. He runs a private practice and specializes in substance abuse counseling.
A licensed professional counselor, that's LPC, and also a master addiction counselor, which is MAC.
The treatment system in Alaska is a quagmire. Arndt says addicts have to get assessments before they can be placed into treatment, which is necessary but can take several months. And after the assessments, it can still take a while to get into an inpatient or outpatient program.
There's just this huge pool of people out there that kind of essentially, I don't want to say they have nowhere to go because there still are options, but in terms of residential treatment, they don't have much of anywhere to go, and they can't get there very quickly even if they decide they want to.
Misconceptions of addiction also hurt the situation. Arndt says in many cases, it's not a matter of willpower or stopping cold turkey. Some addicts cannot stop doing drugs without a major intervention or disruption.
I think some people truly do have the disease of drug addiction, and to scorn or feel contempt for somebody like that would just say, wow, you got cancer, man. That's like, you're pitiful. You know, you shouldn't have let that happen to you. So, and there, even in the medical and even in the counseling profession, there's still quite a bit of that.
Detoxing or the process of coming off a drug can be scary and dangerous. People can die from the process if they are not closely monitored, like what happened to 24-year-old Kelsey Green, who died from a heroin withdrawal in an Anchorage jail earlier this year. At 80 pounds, her death certificate cites malnutrition, dehydration, renal failure, and heart dysrhythmia. Marita Bailey is the clinical director of Sitka Counseling and Prevention Services. She says there is no formal medical detox program in Sitka. Sitka Counseling does have a low-intensity residential treatment program up Indian River Road. Bailey says clients there are often 20 to 30 days sober already before receiving one of the facility's 12 beds, which means they had to detox and start treatment somewhere else.
We know in this field, in substance use field, that, you know, someone doesn't want to wait 6 months to get an assessment to then get treatment. If your motivation is high today, you really want to serve that person as close to today as possible.
This gap, the lack of acute care for drug addiction, may have cost at least one Sitkin her life, according to Erica Burkhouse. Her sister, Lael Grant, disappeared in 2012. Grant was addicted to meth and deeply connected to Sitka's drug culture. Her death was ruled a suspected homicide. Burkhouse convinced Grant to seek treatment during an intervention a year before she disappeared, but the window closed quickly.
Within a couple hours, she was then back to being defensive and not admitting anymore that she had a problem.
For those who do manage to dry out on their own, the meth problem remains. There are more people in serious need than the 12 low-intensity beds in Sitka can serve. Marita Bailey says that the uncertainty of the state's budget could mean even longer waits.
It's a challenge. We're going to have to make accommodations when the budget cuts finally come down and we know what we're facing. But we're going to keep providing services at the, highest capacity that we can, and that's pretty much what all the other providers across the state are looking at.
The Alaska legislature did pass a law this session that makes it easier to access Narcan, a drug that reverses heroin overdoses. And the state has created the Alaska Opioid Policy Task Force to come up with better solutions. The state recently applied for a federal grant to pay for opioid-specific and medically-assisted treatment in Southeast and Anchorage. While those are steps in the right direction, Erica Burkhouse believes that it's still not enough. But perhaps nothing can be when you've lost a loved one to addiction.
We still don't have closure. We still don't know what happened. We just, the investigation, as far as I know, is still ongoing, but it's really at a standstill.
Burkhouse says nobody should have to go through what her family has experienced, and more awareness of the problem could prevent that. She hopes Alaskans keep talking about the addictions friends and neighbors battle every day. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Brielle Schaefer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman, Rasha McChesney, and Jennifer Canfield in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Ann Hillman, Wesley Early, and Ammon Swenson in Anchorage, and Brielle Schaefer in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. BP Alaska, as part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Resource Basket is a training and technical assistance center helping rural communities support healthy, resilient, and culturally connected youth. Tribes and youth-serving organizations can request support, explore resources, and find opportunities at resourcebasket.org or call the team directly at 1-800-478-7227, extension 7396. This message sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.